Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, the show where you get the inside access to the best minds in the game. Each week, Chris has the privilege of chatting with top instructors, legendary players, course architects, and industry insiders. If you're looking to improve your game, gain a new perspective, or just hear some incredible golf stories, you are indeed in the right place.
You see, Chris, I haven't spoken to a press man in my life that is knowledgeable, seriously, as you are. Never.
You do such a great job. It kind of makes me feel good all of a sudden.
You do so much for the game. You're so kind to all of us that are out there in the game. You know, we need more people like you in the game of golf.
Thank you for pressing play. Now, grab your clubs, step up to the tee, and let's get started. This is Next on the Tee.
Hi, folks, and welcome into this week's edition of the Next on the Tee podcast. I am so grateful that you're here and you press play on this week's show. I'm your host, Chris Mascaro, and I am getting all fired up to go back home to Pittsburgh for the U.S. Open and to be coming to the Pittsburgh Brewing Company, oh, by the way, to record a couple of shows. They're going to be hosting watch parties on Thursday and Friday of that week in their tap room. Doors open daily at noon. So I hope my local friends, or if you're in town, you'll come by and say hello and enjoy watching the opening rounds with an ice-cold icy light. I know I will. Or, look, they've got so many other fantastic beverages, so many great things for you to enjoy watching the open and being a part of the tap room there at the Pittsburgh Brewing Company. Again, I hope you'll come by and say hello and enjoy yourself. It's going to be a great time. This week, I've got four fantastic guests that I get the privilege of sharing with you, starting with Mr. Cranky Pants Tom Patry. Look, TP jumped in his car this morning to drive back home to Naples from Key West, which is a 5 to 6 hour ride, depending on the traffic. Then he hopped out of his car, played a round of golf with a couple of his students, then jumped back into his car to get home in time to lead off this show. That's the kind of trooper and friend Tom Patry is. So he's a little extra crispy, which is the way we like him here on the show. This week, TP and I start off going back to the PGA Championship. I get his thoughts, in particular, how the rain-saturated course was, and if the PGA made the right call not to play lift clean in place. We saw that cost Scottie Scheffler a couple of strokes in the first round thanks to a mud ball that he got in the middle of the fairway, oh, by the way, ended up costing him a hook into the water. It persisted throughout the tournament, which upset several players. We'll get Tom's thoughts on that. Plus, Tom has played Oakmont several times, both with and without the trees. We'll hear which way he prefers and thinks is a better challenge. He also talks about the legendary greens where even a small miscalculation can cost you big time. He shares a personal experience around that. And the rough. Some friends of mine that are up there playing the golf course and have over the last couple of days are telling me that rough is sitting about 6 inches high right now and we still got a couple of weeks to go. Tom confirms that if you're just off the fairway and you get into the rough there at Oakmont during a U.S. Open, calf high, it's going to cost you big time. TP is going to join me here shortly. Following him, we get a return visit from 2013 Senior Open champion Mark Wiebe. Mark is awesome. You guys know that. How he doesn't have his own show right now is a mystery to me. And as he points out, perhaps it's because he speaks the truth. What goes on behind the scenes that we don't see or hear about on the PGA Tour? Did the players once upon a time try to unionize and develop a players' association? Mark says yes, you'll hear that story. Watching Full Swing is nice, but there's a whole lot more that the powers that be don't want you to know about. Mark is going to tell you some of those stories. Plus, playing the tour didn't used to be all private jets and staying at the Four Seasons Hotel. Most players sat in coach, three children and a wife traveling with them, staying in motels, not hotels. Mark tells you about those days. And finally, share stories from when he played Oakmont as well. So a lot in store with Mark. He'll join me about a half an hour from now. My Goomba, Rob Strano, kicks off part two of this week's show. Rob has a new state-of-the-art academy, which he just had the grand opening for, oh, by the way, back on May 2nd. If you're anywhere near the panhandle of Florida, you need to go see what Rob has in store for you there. We go back to his time playing out on the PGA Tour and the euchre effect that I think he unnecessarily applied to his career, because when you achieve being in the 1% of the 1% just to get that far, that is a huge accomplishment. Rob also talks about what has to be a tour record that he and his two playing partners achieved on a par 5 at Smithfield Country Club in Greer, South Carolina. You're going to hear that amazing story. and the power that belief and positive mindset have on the course and everyday life. You guys know how much we like to focus on the mental aspect of the game because we do so much negative talk out on the golf course. So Rob's going to give you some specific examples about how having that positive mindset, even when you're having adversity out on the golf course, can change things around. Looking forward to having Rob, like I say, kicking off part two of the show. And then we're going to round things out with a visit from the confidence doctor, Dr. Bob Winters. Doctor's been doing some traveling recently. He went out to Hawaii and played some golf on one of the lesser known islands. So you'll hear about those courses. We've got the Women's U.S. Open going on this week, and he has some players in the field. So you'll hear about the work he's done with those individuals. Plus, his students are doing great things in the junior realm. He's got one of his juniors over in Asia and the Philippines doing some outstanding work for the folks over there. So you're going to want to hear that as well. A lot to get into with Doc as well. He'll join me here in segment number four. So a lot of great stuff in store for you, as usual, here on Next on the Tee. But like I say, each and every week, thank you all so much for tuning in and taking the journey with me. Okay, but before we get into this week's show, I want to start off by giving a shout out to our good friends over at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. TribLive.com is the leading news website for Western Pennsylvania with news around the clock. Pittsburgh Pro Sports coverage, a high school sports network, a podcast network, which you can find Next on the Tee on. So go out and bookmark TribLive.com or download the TribLive app for free and stay up to date with all the news in Western Pennsylvania and this show. I also want to talk about our friends over at the Pittsburgh Brewing Company and Iron City Beer, a brand that I have loved my whole life and started drinking when I was 21 years old, of course. Whether you're a hacker or a scratcher, the secret to a successful day on the links is knowing when it's time to grab an iron, even if that means keeping it in the bag till the 19th hole. If it's been a while since you've reached for Pittsburgh staple beer, it's time to revisit Iron City. Thanks to their incredible new facility in Creighton, the best-tasting Iron City beer ever made is now available at a course near you. Iron City pairs well with any lie and sky and serves as a friendly reminder that there's always next round. Iron City beer, best enjoyed while enjoying life. And folks, this year, get ready to experience the game like you've never experienced it before at the Keep. It's the brand-new Bill Bergen and Reese Jones co-designed course up at Macklemore. Nestled high atop Lookout Mountain, the Keep offers breathtaking vistas that are even more spectacular in person than they are in the pictures and the videos. With its challenging layout and awe-inspiring views, every round there is an unforgettable adventure. Whether you're taking on the signature holes or just soaking in the scenery, the Keep is where your best golf meets nature's finest backdrop. So grab your clubs and join us up at Macklemore this year. The Keep is open for preview play and it's waiting for you. But you gotta hurry now because spots and availability are filling up fast. So don't wait. Check out both courses, the Highlands and the Keep, for yourself online at themacklemore.com. And then do yourself and your buddies, or yourself and your family a solid by getting your spot reserved now. And experience distance and forgiveness all at once with the new QI35 driver from TaylorMade. QI35 is designed to give golfers more distance from more of the face while maintaining maximized forgiveness through high MOI designs. Whether you're looking for low spin and maximum workability, or easy launch and plenty of adjustability, it's available in low spin, core, and max models. QI35 also has a full assortment of fairway woods and rescues to deliver distance and forgiveness throughout the top end of your bag. Check them all out online at TaylorMadeGolf.com. Okay, now back in Next on the Tee with me as our resident director of instruction, Tom Patry. We're about to start the summer golf season, and Tom is ready to help you play your best. You can find him down at Twin Eagles Golf Club in Naples, Florida, as you guys all know. But if you can't get down there, well, then book a lesson with him through the V1 video app. Get his help no matter where you are, anywhere on the planet. You can also check him out online at TomPatry.com or on Instagram at TomPatryGolf, where he's taking your questions each morning around 8 a.m. Eastern Time on Instagram Live. Also has several fantastic guests. And I've already joined him. I'm sure we'll hear about the future guest list as well. Be sure to check that page out each and every morning to check Tom out. He's fantastic. And I'm excited he is back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, TP, how are you, my friend?
There
you go. A little enthusiasm. Mr. Cranky Pants, how are you?
I'm tired.
No doubt.
Had a long ride today. I was down in Key West for a couple of days with Mrs. Patry. But I'm back, and I drove back today and jumped on the golf course at 2 o'clock after a 5-hour drive. Played 18 holes with a couple of students, and now I'm with you, buddy.
Dude, you are the most sought after guy on the planet. I think if Elvis was still around, it would be a close matchup between he or you.
No contest.
Indeed. All right, now before we get deep into our conversation, because I know that you're kind of fired up this week. You've got your 9th annual marathon round of golf coming up on June 17th, where you raise money for the South Florida PGA Foundation. Remind everybody about that.
Chris, thank you for mentioning it. I really appreciate that. This will be my 9th marathon, where I try to raise both awareness and funds for that foundation that actually funds, I think, up to six or seven charities now. One of them is a children's hospital in West Palm Beach, Junior Golf in South Florida, Habitat for Humanity, PJ Hope Foundation for Veterans. And I'm going to miss a couple, but there's more than that. And being my 9th, I think I've got about $12,000 in donations so far, and we still have time. So anybody out there who wants to jump in, I'd really appreciate that. I have a QR code I can send you if you just email me at tpatry@mindspring.com. I think to date we've raised in our eight years about $70,000. So if we can get this thing up a little bit, you know, I'd like to get this thing over $100,000 in the next 2 years for the foundation. I think the record number of holes for the day is 153.
Wow.
So we're going to see if we can beat that. Although your man has a hip pointer right now.
Oh.
Yeah, which feels really good. So we're going to jump in with a couple ibuprofen and we're going to gut it out anyway.
Wow. And you also have that QR code, right? It's on your Instagram page as well. That's where I got it.
It is. It is on the Instagram page. And you are a donator, and I really appreciate that, Chris. It's amazing to me, and I don't want to sound like doom and gloom. It's amazing to me, out of all the people that I teach, and you know, I have a pretty good handle on people's finances, you know, whether they're very well off or you know, they're working guys or gals. It's amazing to me who jumps in and who doesn't. You know, I mean, I have folks that don't jump in that, you know, they spend more money in their bar bill every night than the highest donator so far. And then you have guys who are real working guys that are really, you know, work hard to make their dollars. And they seem to be sometimes the most generous. I don't really understand it, you know, and I try not to understand it, but, you know, it's such a great cause, and the foundation does such great work. You know, I have no problem shaming people into opening up their wallets, because it's something that really impacts lives in South Florida and really does great work, really great work.
Indeed. All right. So as we talk a little golf here, I want to go back to the PGA Championship, and for all the great moments at Quail Hollow, the players had lots of complaints about how the PGA of America made them play the ball down when the course conditions throughout the tournament, even into Sunday, were very wet. A lot of mud balls. Scotty called that out after the first round, cost him a couple of strokes. It was still a problem going into Sunday and throughout the morning on Sunday. Were you surprised at all that they didn't play lift clean in place when the ball was in the fairway?
You know, I've got a couple of different takes on this, Chris. One is that, as we remember, during the practice rounds, they had torrential downpours. I mean, yep. Like major downpours. The golf course was saturated, and the mud ball was a real thing for sure. And I'm sure PGA America officials were saying, "Major, we're not going to touch the ball." But you know, in not touching the ball and playing with that situation and those mud balls, you could potentially change the outcome of golf history. You know. You know, if you get beat by somebody that's more skilled or plays better, that's one thing. But if you get beat by a freak break where you have mud on the ball and all of a sudden the ball veers off and goes somewhere and it creates a big number, I don't think that's very equitable. So I think they missed there. I think they missed at least the first two rounds possibly the whole tournament, but at least the first two rounds, and not putting your hand on the golf ball and getting everybody on equal footing. On the other side of that, whether it's Scotty or anybody else, I don't think you air those things publicly. I think you do that with officials behind closed doors. I don't think you have to call out officials, of course, set up people publicly and make a spectacle of it. Is he right? He is right. It was not equitable and it wasn't fair. I think you should have had Lifkin in place, but I don't think, you know, you go bitching and moaning about that publicly in a news conference. So that's just both sides of that take.
Tom, if you ask most players and probably golf fans as well to rank all four majors, I think almost everyone would put the PGA last. Golf Magazine published an article stating it's the most erratic of the majors, and the players always rank it last among the four majors. When you think about, hey, look, do you want to win a Masters? Do you want to win a U.S. Open? Do you want to win an Open Championship? I think those guys would all rank those up there at the top, maybe in a little different order amongst those three, but I'm pretty sure they'd put the PGA last. Even a two-time PGA champion like Justin Thomas or John Rahm, when asked about what a PGA championship course is, what it feels like to play in a PGA, they were stumped to give an answer. Now, we all know what the Masters is, and of course, Augusta National. We all know the U.S. Open courses like Oakmont coming up here in a couple of weeks, Pebble, Pinehurst, number two. We know the Open courses and what it feels like at St. Andrews or Carnoustie or Troon and Royal Birkdale, you probably more than anybody. Does the PGA need to do something to bring more character to that tournament?
Well, let me just back up a little bit. And here's where I get in trouble again, as usual. And you're baiting me, so thank you very much. It's not the fourth major, it's the fifth major.
Oh.
If you ask anybody out there, I think you said to them, would you like to win the PGA Championship or would you like to win the Tournament Players Championship? I think you'd be very surprised at how many guys would go TPC over PGA.
Wow.
I really believe that. I think that I don't think I'm gonna say that publicly, but I think that if you know you poured truth serum down their throat, you'd get a lot of guys going TPC in front of PGA. It's a stronger field. It's on year in and year out a better golf course than some of the golf courses the PGA plays at. If you're gonna tell me that the PGA Championship at Valhalla is on a better golf course than TPC, I'm going to laugh in your face. And aside from that, I think that you look at the excitement created at TPC every year. It's pretty strong. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, for sure.
So and here's where I really get in trouble. We own the PGA Championship, the PGA of America. Okay. And a lot of people don't understand the difference between the PGA and the PGA Tour. PGA of America is us, the club pro, the teaching professional. We own that property. And I get we want to showcase some of our better club professionals. But right now, we allow 20 spots from the National Club Pro Championship to qualify for the PGA Championship. And I think that ship has sailed. I think that, you know, if you want to put five club professionals in the tournament, I might be able to handle that. But 20 spots taken away from world-class players, put 20 club pros in who traditionally maybe one guy makes the cut, usually not, none made the cut this year. I think that really weakens the product.
All right. So, you know, getting back to the question, does it need more character? Because the writer of the article, who was Sean Zach, by the way, and he suggests that they start the tournament a day early on Wednesday, play two rounds of stroke play, cut the field down to the top 32, then put those players in brackets for match play, which, oh, by the way, the PGA once upon a time was a match play tournament. Is that an idea? Do you think there's something else that needs to happen?
No, I don't think match play. I don't think match play qualifies the best champion. I think stroke play is far more demanding and you know, it was changed for match play because for that very reason, I didn't think I necessarily identified the best player every year. Stroke play identifies the best player. I mean, it's a lot more taxing. You know, when you can make a seven and only be one down, the guy made a four, that's not that's not championship golf as far as it's fun. It's interesting, but it's not major championship golf. So I stroke play stays. I think that you've got to get back into the rotation of really traditional great golf courses, along like the U.S. Open. You've got to get the Oaklands, the Bethpage Blacks, the Shinnecock Hills, the Torrey Pines. You've got to go back and really bolster the lineup. How many times have we played Valhalla now in the last 8 or 10 years? It's not a major championship golf course. So I think we've got to be really careful about sites we choose and things like that. And again, I think we've got to make the field stronger in every way we can.
Okay. Do you run into the danger, though, in doing that, Tom, of we're seeing for major championship golf on the PGA Tour, it's the same, 10, 12 golf courses between the U.S. Open and the PGA. Does that get stale? Do you need to branch it out? Maybe you go to Canada and play in a Royal Montreal, or you go somewhere in Mexico, or do you branch it out?
You don't think we have 30 great golf courses to rotate on to stay out of the same rotation as the U.S. Open? The U.S. Open, USGA has identified a rotation now, right? If I'm mistaken, Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, they've identified Shinnecock, Oakmont, Pinehurst, Torrey Pines. What am I missing?
Pebble,
Wingfoot, right? Is that
yep.
Okay? Yep. So you stay out of the same rotation. So you go to, you go to second tier top of the greatest. There's plenty of golf courses out there that would host that major that are
the Erin Hills of the world.
No,
but not Erin Hills.
How about a place like Chicago Golf Club? How about a place like, I mean, I have to think PGA National, not bad.
Yeah.
Although it's a regular tour stop, and I don't like that. Yep. But that, if we thought this through, Champions in Houston. We could think.
We could come up with another 7 or 8.
Absolutely. Yeah, and identify them as your rotation, and go to the table with those people and say, listen, we want you to be the PGA Championship rotation. I think you could do that with a little thought.
Looking ahead a couple of weeks to the U.S. Open at Oakmont, you played the course several times. Tell everyone about the course and what's waiting on those guys.
So it's funny you say that, because this afternoon when I got home, because you and I spoke on the phone earlier today when I was driving back from the Keys, and I drove up to a place in Naples called Windstar and played with a couple of my students. And one of the students is a golf professional who shall go unnamed because I don't want to embarrass him, but he had his first trip to Oakmont this past week. Pretty good player, hits it pretty far, knows how to play the game. And he said to me, I know you've played there a lot. What am I going to shoot? I said, if you break 85, you played a hell of a round of golf. And he said, 85? Are you kidding me? I said, I'm just telling you, if you break 85, if you're going to play in that golf course in these conditions, he said, now you're crazy. I can break 80 there. He shot 86.
Wow.
Yeah, and he said, Tom, I didn't even hit it bad. I said, you don't have to. But people don't understand U.S. Open conditions. The golf course now is grown in. The fairways are reduced to 25 yards wide. They're firm and fast. They're slopey. They're hard to keep the ball in the fairway unless you hit it right down an exact line. And once you leave the fairway, you're not advancing the golf ball. You're just trying to get it back in play somewhere. And then the green conditions, the speed of the greens at Oakmont and the severity of the greens is something to behold. I told you earlier on the phone, I think if you're a sinner and you get sent to hell, you have to play Carnoustie and Oakmont every day for the rest of your life back to back. That would be the worst thing you could do to me, sending me to hell. I played both of those places in open conditions and people don't understand how hard they are. I grew up, Chris, as a kid playing Bethpage Black. It was one of the places I grew up as a junior player playing. And I've played it a bunch of times since the renovation and restoration. And under normal daily conditions, just public conditions, it's so damn hard. It's unbelievable. You put it in open conditions with rough and green speeds and tighter fairways, people just, it's hard for the average guy to understand what those places are like in those conditions. It's so hard.
So I want to take a couple of things you mentioned there a step further, U.S. Open conditions and advancing the golf ball, because I was talking to some guys up there today who played the course in the last few days, and they tell me the rough is currently about 6 inches high and the greens are off the charts fast. Now, when we traditionally think about rough at a U.S. Open, we imagine, well, there's fairway and then there's intermediate rough. And then when you get a little further out of there, the thick rough is unbelievable. Well, at Oakmont, there is no intermediate rough. It's fairway or calf high rough. They're saying that Angel Cabrera's winning score of 5 over back in 2007 might be too low for this year's tournament. Do you like watching players struggle like that and par being such an incredibly good score? Do you rather see a leaderboard where we have things like the Masters, where typically the winning score is somewhere in the area of 10 under?
I like the fact that the majors, including TPC, all present a different entertainment. I like the fact that, you know, at the Open Championship, it's windy, firm, and fast. At the Masters, it's a back nine on Sunday with a lot of things that could possibly happen on those par fives. I like the fact that at places like Oakmont and Wingfoot, you know, you got to pull up your boots and be a big boy. I think they all present a different type of entertainment, a different type of golf. I think you could argue against me that maybe that situation doesn't always identify the best player because of a break or two they get or don't get in the rough in certain situations, in those kind of rough situations. But listen, that's the personality of the U.S. Open. It always has been, and I'm sure it always will be, right, wrong, or indifferent. I like the diversity of the majors. I like the diversity a lot. They're all different conditions, and that's why the career Grand Slam is so hard. Because the player who achieves the career Grand Slam has overcome a lot of different diversity and shot values in different types of venues. That's why not many people have done that. You know, because there are not many skilled players that can adapt to all those different situations.
When the players do hit it in the rough, and again, I'm being told you're going to be lucky to see a speck of white when you're looking for the golf ball. Our friend Bob Ford, when he joined me a couple of weeks ago, said they better be very careful when they're looking for the golf ball in the rough to properly identify it. Because with member play still going on, at least at that time, and again, this past weekend, there's sure to be stray balls still out there when the tournament starts that they didn't find.
Right.
So for you, for me, for the players that you work with, when you have yourself in a position like that, you're playing under those kinds of conditions, how do you get the ball back in play? What's the best, smartest play when you're just a few feet or a few inches, probably is better, a few inches off the fairway, and now you're trying to hack it out of there and just advance the ball? Because we all know thick rough like that, it's going to grab the hosel. It could twist the face. I mean, what's the smart play there, Tom?
Oh, yeah. I mean, all those things, Chris, all those things are not only true, but they're real. I mean, there are going to be cases where you have to take a very lofted club and come out 90 degrees sideways. And that might require you only to hit the ball 5 or 6 yards to get back into play and leave yourself an incredibly long third shot, and now you're risking making more than a bogey under those conditions. But that's the Open. That's just the way that's going to happen. And there are going to be guys, they're going to try to bite off more than they can chew, and you're going to see some train wrecks. You're going to see some absolute train wrecks. You know, we've seen guys, you know, at Oakmont, we've seen guys at Wingfoot, which is traditionally set up very, very difficult too, as a hard golf course as well, you know, try to bite off more than they could chew, and it led to, you know, some really big numbers. We all remember the TC Chen double hit at Oakland Hills.
Yeah.
Going back a long time. That's think about a double hit, and that what caused that double hit. The club got grabbed in the rough and then suddenly accelerated. He flipped the face upward and caught the ball a second time within a few feet of where it left. That's how hard those places are and how penal that situation is. And Oakmont traditionally has always sported maybe the most difficult of all conditions as far as the rough and the green speeds.
Yes.
So you bet, you know, and I guess, Chris, too, I think the advantage that goes to in some degree, physical strength and club speed, right? I mean, a guy like, I'm not belittling this person. A guy like Brian Harman in the rough is at a disadvantage compared to a guy like maybe Bryson DeChambeau, able to get the club through the rough in that condition. But it's going to be. You remember the book by Dick Schaap, The Massacre at Wingfoot?
Yes.
It's a great, great read. I don't know if anybody out there is listening. If you haven't read that one, 73 open at Wingfoot that Hale Irwin won with, I think, 8 over. And those conditions were similar to the ones you're going to see this year. That's a great read if you haven't read it. But that place was set up so hard that year. I mean, guys went home crying in the afternoon. they were just crying. They wanted to get off the golf course. And that's the U.S. Open. That's the U.S. Open.
You mentioned the green speeds at Oakmont, and they are certainly legendary. People may not know that the stimp meter was actually invented at Oakmont in 1935. Edward Stimson, while watching the 35 U.S. Open there, got inspired when he watched Gene Sayers and put one off the green. Now, the USGA wasn't all that interested in his stimp meter. They didn't adopt it until 1978. But you've been out there, and you've dealt with those greens. What was it like putting those greens? Because from what I understand, they roll true, but they're not that easy.
So your friend Mr. Ford and Mr. Jack Druga, the retired professional from Shinnecock, both good friends of mine, one of the first times I played Oakmont took me out there, and they watched me put it on the first green from what was the very, maybe just on the front fringe to a middle pin that I putted past the middle pin, off the back of the green, into the rough behind the green. So, in effectively, I putted it about 45 or 50 feet past the hole that I was putting to. And it seemed like it took a minute, at least a full minute, to travel across the green and disappear over the green. And they were laughing so hard, they were crying.
I bet they were.
Which, and they could have given me a little clue, but of course they did. But, when that happens to you, and you're watching this ball kind of move ever so slowly, but keep moving and rotating, and keeps going, and now you're shell shocked going to the next hole. Because now you get on the next green, you're like, oh my God, what am I going to do? What if I get above the hole here somewhere? Forget it can really play with your mind. And there are going to be guys out there who get off to a not so great start, or a situation where they putt a golf ball and it does something they don't expect it to do. It can really play with your head,
And you played the course when it had trees and then after they cut them all down. Which way for you was more challenging?
Oh, I like it now much better. I think aesthetically the golf course is incredibly beautiful now. I mean, there's so many great vistas on the golf course, and the fans who will watch the Open will stand on certain hillsides and be able to look almost across the entire property. As you know, Chris, but maybe the average listener doesn't know, the golf course is divided by an interstate.
Walk, the highway.
After you walk the first green, you walk through across a bridge onto the second tee across an interstate. And there's some areas on the front nine where you're up on a hillside and you're looking back across and you don't even see you don't see the highway below you, but you're looking across the whole property back to the clubhouse and you can see almost every hole on the golf course in certain areas. It's gorgeous. Now, when it had trees, I know you asked me today, was it harder? The trees were really not in play. They weren't like hitting out of chutes or anything like that. They were there, but they were back off the rough line. So you usually didn't get to the trees because once the ball landed in the rough, it stopped and it wasn't going any further. You had to hit it into the trees to be in the trees, which was pretty far off line. I just think it's a cool golf course now, because now they've also planted in some areas some fescue and stuff like that. And it's more, if you look at the original pictures of the golf course when it was built, it's more exactly like it was when it was built originally.
The par 3 eighth hole is going to play 290 yards. For most of us, that's a short par 4. When Victor Hovland was asked about it, he said, when you have to take a head cover off to play a par 3, I think it's getting a little silly. What's your take on a par three playing that distance?
I don't think they'll play that. I don't think they'll play that hole at 290. I don't know if you're aware of this, Chris. The second hole at Shinnecock, they lengthened the tee for the last Shinnecock Open to 275, but they never during the tournament played it back. It's uphill. Green is crowned. The green is designed to receive a mid iron basically. And they played it at 215 or 220 one of the days, but they never played it back where they could have played it. I don't think you'll see the tee at 290. I think you might see the tee at, you could see the 240 at 230. It's a pretty good size green. That you can attack from right to left. There's a long bunker that moves diagonally up the left side of the green. I'll be surprised if they play past that distance really well.
So, Tom, if you look at all of the U.S. Opens played at Oakmont dating back to 1973, Johnny Miller won it that year. He was 5 under par. Larry Nelson won it in 83. He was 4 under par. Ernie Els was also 5 under par when he won it in 1994. We mentioned Cabrera doing it at 5 over in 2007, and Dustin Johnson was 4 under when he won it in 2016. So history would tell you that 4 or 5 under should be the winning score. You taking the over or the under on that?
No, I'm taking the over. I don't think. I would tell you right now, if conditions stay dry and it's firm and fast, that nobody breaks par. Can I tell you a quick story, Chris, about Oakmont?
Please do.
So when I was at Westchester, we had a situation where we had Johnny Miller in for a speaking engagement, and I had never met Johnny at this time, and I got the assignment of going down to Kennedy Airport and LaGuardia Airport and picking him up, take him back up to the club, have lunch with him, show him around the club, and then he was going to speak and do a clinic on the range in the afternoon, and then speak in the evening to the entire membership. So, you know, what does everybody want to talk to? I want to talk about the 63 at Oakmont, right? I mean, I want to hear the story. And not knowing anything about his feelings about it, I picked him up at the airport. Johnny's kind of a quiet, reserved guy. He really didn't give me the time of day, quite frankly, when I picked him up at the airport, got him in the car, driving from LaGuardia back to the club. And I was going to take him to lunch at the club first. Had a table reserved in the men's grill at the time. There was a men's grill at the time. Which no longer exists. And we sat down to lunch, and I'm dying to ask him. I'm just, you know, I want to hear about the 63. I want to hear about that round of golf. And he's not giving me any openings at all, and I don't want to press it. He's kind of standoffish. And all of a sudden, our lunch comes to the table, and the waiter walks away, and he looks up at me and says, "You want to hear about the 63? I go, "Excuse me?" He goes, "Well, you want to ask me, don't you?" I said, "Well, I said I do, but if it's an imposition." He goes, "No, I'll tell you about it." He says, "You know, I don't know if you remember that Open. I was in contention after 36 holes. In the third round, I shot 76, and I thought I blew myself out of the tournament." I said, "I remember." He said, "You know, I went out to warm up the last day, and I was having a really, really bad warm up session." Now you gotta understand this story, because it gets a little bizarre. He was having a really bad warm-up session on the range before the fourth round. And all of a sudden, I heard a voice. I said, "Excuse me?" He said, "Well, I heard a voice." They said, "A voice?" He goes, "I said, somebody was talking." He goes, no, a voice." I said, "Oh, yeah, what did the voice say?" He said, "It said, open up." I said, "It said what?" He goes, "Open up your stance, open up." And I kind of looked around, and I opened up a little bit, and I started kind of hitting it really good. And then the voice said something else. I said, "What did it say?" He said, "Open up more." So I'm sitting there at this lunch table. I'm thinking, this guy is out of his mind. So he says, "So I opened up a little bit more." He goes, "And I started flushing it, just absolutely flushing it." And if you remember Miller in the 70s, when his iron play was good, it was spectacular.
Yeah.
He said, "And I went out there and I shot 63 because the voice told me to open up." I said,
"Alrighty then."
I said, "That's the story." He goes, "That's the story." He says, "That's all I'm going to say about the 63.
That sounds like divine intervention to me.
That's it.
Voice of God.
This guy is a cuckoo clock, you know. but what a spectacular player he was. And I don't know if you remember at Tucson and Phoenix one year back to back. I think the combined winning scores for the two. I think he beat the tour by like 18 or 19 shots that year. in those two events combined.
Yeah, he was dominant from the early 70s, probably through the late 70s. He was one of the dominant players.
He was incredible. Sure. Incredible. And I'll say one thing, just to give him a good send-off here. The talk he did that night in front of the membership was one of the best talks I've ever heard a player give in my life. It was it was spectacular. He was forthcoming. He was open. He was entertaining, but good in front of a crowd. But one-on-one, he's kind of shy and quiet and kind of quirky, but he did a great job in front of the membership.
Tom, before I let you go, remind our listeners about TP Live on Instagram each morning, 8 a.m. Eastern time. I'm sure you've got some guests lined up. You've certainly had a lot of great ones. Plus, you're taking everybody's questions. So tell everybody about it again.
Yeah, Chris, thanks. It's not almost every morning, but almost every morning, but 8 o'clock, I go live on Instagram. You can ask in. You can request in if I don't have a guest and give the old pro a little grief if you want, or ask questions, comments, or concerns. I've got Nick Serban, who's the co-founder and co-owner of Club Champion, the national fitting company, coming on the 30th. And I think it's June 19th. I have Terry Hashimoto, who I consider the father of ground force, who's come up with a new ground force apparatus he's going to talk about. And he guy knows more about ground force pressure than vertical pressure than anybody I know on the planet. He's just a brilliant guy. Plays at the University of Miami, was a fine player, played a little PGA Tour golf, and kind of has dedicated his life to the science of golf now. And an old friend and a good friend. So I'm looking forward to him having on. I've had Chris Cuomo on, Damon Hack, Bob Ford, Jimmy Roberts, Chris Mascaro has been on. It's kind of fun, and it's something I do as many mornings as it'll allow me to get in there early enough to do that if I doesn't interfere with my lesson schedule. It's been a lot of fun, and that's if anybody in the world can ask in any morning they want. So it's been a fun thing.
And remind them one more time how they can get involved with the Marathon Round of Golf and supporting the South Florida PGA Foundation.
Yeah, if you go onto my Instagram page and go back and scroll through it, there's a graphic there with a QR code you can use. And if you can't find that, you just email me at tpatry@mindspring.com. I'm happy to send that to you. Those donations are really appreciated. The foundation is a great, great, great. It's something that impacts so many lives, and I've become. It's been kind of my favorite thing to do once a year, for, you know, just to try to raise awareness and help them with a couple of dollars and keep that thing moving forward. And I appreciate you bringing it up again, Chris. But the best place to find me is every other Tuesday night with the greatest host on the planet on Next on the Tee.
Indeed.
Indeed.
You're the best, my friend. I can't wait to catch up with you again in a couple of weeks. Stay safe. My best to Mrs. Patry, and I look forward to each day that we have an opportunity to chat. And I can't thank you enough for all you've meant to me in this show. You're the best, my friend.
Oh, Rob Strand always said hi, pal.
I will absolutely do it.
Bye, buddy.
See you, Tom. That is a great Tom Patry. Again, at Tom Patry Golf on Instagram. Check out that page every morning. He's just wonderful. His guests are great, and Tom's style is outstanding. So you're going to enjoy that. TomPatry.com is his website. Be sure to go out and subscribe to his YouTube channel. So many free playing lessons are waiting for you right there. So Tom's fantastic. You're really going to enjoy all of that. And I look forward to catching up with him again a couple of weeks from now. Okay, coming up next is a wonderful friend of the show going back several years and 2013 Senior Open champion, Mark Wiebe. Before I bring Wiebes into the show, I want to remind you about our wonderful friends over at On Point Golf and their out of this world On Point Golf Ball Marker. And if you don't have one, folks, you really need to go check it out at onpointgolf.us. Get the number one ball marker in the game of golf. On Point is the only three-dimensional ball marker out there. With alignment technology and a removable coin that is approved to use according to the rules of golf. As you know, putting is all about line and pace. Mark your ball with On Point, engage with your three-dimensional ball marker, and have more confidence in your line. Execute the putt, and you're going to lower your scores. Do what the likes of Jim Furyk, PGA professionals, and amateurs alike are doing now. They use the number one ball marker in golf, and they lower their scores. You know Ken Duke and Thongchai JD. They won for the first time on the PGA Tour in 2023, and they were using an On Point ball marker.
Get yours at onpointgolf.us and make more putts. And oh, by the way, you can also customize the removable coin for any club, event, or corporate outing. They make really great tee gifts and custom products. That's also going to help lower your score. I use On Point ball markers. Mine is black and gold, 3D black golf ball with a gold line down the middle to help me line up my putts. It's like having a 15th club in my bag. It's helped my game. Why wouldn't you let it help yours? Again, onpointgolf.us. See what I'm talking about. Order yours today. Now back in Next on the Tee with me is 2013 Senior Open Champion and now one of the top instructors in our game, Mark Wiebe. Let me remind you a little bit about Wiebe's background. He is from Seaside, Oregon and grew up in Escondido, California. Played his college golf first at Palomar Junior College and then transferred to San Jose State. While at Palomar, he was the individual medalist at the 1977 California and Idaho Amateur Championships. He was named second team All-American in 1979 at San Jose State, turned pro in 1980 and got his first start on the PGA Tour in 1983. Got his first career win at the 1985 Anheuser-Busch Classic when he beat our friend John Mahaffey with a birdie on the first playoff hole. Mark won again the following year at the Hardy's Golf Classic. In 2007, Mark matched Bobby Watkins' record for being the youngest winner on the Champions Tour at 50 years and 10 days old when he won the SAS Championship. In 2013, like I mentioned a moment ago, he won the Senior Open Championship at Royal Birkdale, defeating Bernhard Langer on the fifth playoff hole. Later in 2013, he captured the Pacific Links Hawaii Championship in a playoff over Corey Pavin. In all, he won 8 times as a professional, twice on the PGA Tour, 5 more times out on the Champions Tour, plus the 1986 Colorado Open. He was inducted into the Colorado Golf Hall of Fame in 2011. He is an absolutely fantastic guy and a wonderful friend, and I am thrilled he is back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Wiebe, thanks for coming back on the show.
Hey, bud, how are you doing, man?
I'm hanging in there. How about you? How you feeling?
I'm feeling pretty good. The introduction is so flattering, and the main thing is it makes me feel very young again, which is not
well,
a
that's
bad
good.
Thing.
Yeah, that's a good side effect.
That's awesome. So thank you for that.
Absolutely. So, Mark, I tell you, I keep waiting for the Mark Wiebe show to come on the PGA Tour radio out there on Sirius XM. Ever since I heard you with Pittsburgh native Rocco Mediate on his show and the great job you did there, I've told you many times, I'm expecting any day now for the Mark Wiebe show. It hasn't happened, but I got to believe your phone's got to be ringing, is it not?
Well, you're so kind. I got to tell you, I would love to do that. I'm not so sure that the tour would like me to do that because I'm going to tell the truth about some things. So I have a feeling they may not want me on that radio. But okay. But who knows? I would love to do that. I think it's would be so informative. For everyone to know how it really goes down. And it'd be fun to hear, and it's an interesting story. And my particular age, my vintage, lived through it. So it's really a fun story. I'd love to share that on some kind of a show. But so far, I have no leads. But I'm always interested in hearing if there's any, I should pursue that more. I don't know.
I think you should. So,
yeah, I'd love to do that in my, and now my new life that I'm living.
All right. So now you've cracked the door a little bit and you talked about truth. What truth out there do you think that fans need to be aware of that we have no idea about?
Well,
I don't want to get you in any trouble, Mark.
No, I don't think I can get any trouble. Again, I just tell the truth. There's a variety of things. I just don't ever think that, I don't know how to say that the regular person, the regular golf viewer, understands behind the scenes. Unless you've been in a business that has stuff going on behind the scenes, and it goes from who's on TV the most, what sponsor pays the most money, what we were in the dark about. My main concern is we really did try in a very professional manner, we meaning I was one of the followers, to have some sort of a players association, because we couldn't do a union because we're independent contractors. So a players association would be good to hear from all the players, but we really don't hear from all the players. We just hear from certain players. And that, I don't know what you want to call that other than selective gathering of information. But I can assure you, I can't assure you. I'm hoping that it changes here as we go along, because pretty quick, we have so many golfers that are in line waiting for their turn. More Scottie Schefflers, more Ricky Fowlers, more Justin Thomases, more Jordan Spieth. They're just in line. We just haven't seen them. And I'm looking for expansion because of the amount of golfers, and we're actually shrinking a bit. And we never know why. It's almost like maybe they want to, like a TV show where you have a certain cast of characters each week, and you watch those, that cast, whatever show it is, Friends or Office or. And it seems like we're becoming kind of that way. I think Lucas Glover put it the best with the tour's not becoming more competitive. It's becoming less competitive. And I'm 100% behind that. But we don't hear about those stories. That's my, I guess, way to enlighten the listener. You don't get to hear that. You don't get to hear how much it costs to play on the tour, and you get to see on that show that's on about the, I can't remember the name of the show now. I haven't seen it yet. The show about the golfers.
Yeah, I know which one you're talking about.
Anyway, you see them all flying on private jets and stuff. And you're like, yeah, that's not how the norm is. I understand that money's more and you get to spend more, but that's not everybody has a private jet or a link into a private jet where they can use it every week. That's just, you're talking about a certain percentage of players, but I'm all about, the more the merrier. There's certainly enough money to go around for everyone. And I don't know why we're busy trying to keep it to these signature events are, I guess, are great. But I would like the public to know things like that. So at the end of the year, you're trying to get in the top so many players, whatever the exempt status is, let's say 100. Yet I'm not in those tournaments that the top 50 are. And by the way, there's not cuts, and there's, I don't know, 8 times more the amount of money, 5 times more the amount of money. But I have to compete against that guy that's in those and I'm not, for the year-end status. And I'm like, well, that's not really a fair playing field, is it? Shouldn't we all be competing in everything for the, shouldn't we all have cuts, right? if we're gonna have cuts? Anyway, those are the things that I don't think people all understand, unless you're a super avid golf fan.
You were mentioning the show on TV. I'm assuming you were referring to Full Swing on Netflix.
Yes,
we get a little behind the scenes flavor for what PGA Tour players are dealing with and going through and all that sort of
thing. Yeah, and that's they're gonna show you what they want to show you.
Right.
That's kind of, and maybe that's how it works. I don't know. I like the real deal. You know, my wife and I watched like Formula One, and we watched the surfing one, same deal. We watched another tennis, kind of the same thing as the Formula One, kind of like a full swing. So we've watched all these different sports and we start going, wow, are all these sports kind of showing you what they want to show you? Or are they showing us the real deal? Because when I watch golf, I'm going, yeah, that's not kind of the real deal. You know, people have to fly economy still, for instance. And maybe they might be not staying at the Hyatt Regency or the, or whatever, one of the huge brands for $250 a night. Maybe they found a place that's $150 a night and they can save money. Stuff like that, I think, is a neat story. I would like to tell that story because I lived all that. It's not like I'm making it up. It's pretty easy to remember. My favorite story is one year going to Anheuser-Busch, which is that first tournament that I won. My wife and I had 13 pieces of luggage. When they picked us up, I had three kids. It was summertime, and we were out on the road with three little kiddos. And they had to pick us up with a car with a pulling a trailer to get us back to Williamsburg, Virginia. I mean, so when I watch Full Swing and I see them flying in on their jets and stuff, going, yeah, okay. Okay. I understand things have changed, but come on, you know, really?
Yeah.
So I think those are fun stories. I don't know.
Absolutely they are. But I want to go back to something you said a little bit ago. Was there an effort once upon a time to get a players association together to potentially unionize? And I don't understand if you guys were independent contractors, how that's different from what the Major League Baseball players are or the NFL players are. They're essentially independent contractors. They sign individual contracts to play for a team for a while, but then when that contract's up, they're free agents and go wherever they want. It seems like that would be kind of the same thing for you guys.
Yeah, that would probably be nice, but it's kind of not that way. You know, you sign your name to a paper, and it always seemed like when it was super convenient for the tour with any issues at all, we were independent contractors. But then when it wasn't convenient, it seemed like it was all of a sudden, well, we signed our name to a paper saying we'll be part of this club. So you're kind of going, well, how can you be members of a club and be an independent contractor, you know, at the same time? So it just wasn't as clear. I think it was a little bit murky compared to how it sounds with the NFL and the Major League Baseball. Just to me, I don't know anything. I just know that I think those are a little different. But again, you know, I lived it for 20 years, and I think the tour is great. I think anywhere that you can play, I mean, I'm a professional golfer, so anywhere I can go play and make money, because that's my living, I'm ready to go do it. And that means one year I went to South America and went on a tour there. And I remember Payne going over to Asia, Payne Stewart. So rest in peace, Payne. So we all played where we had to play to be a professional golfer. And the tour was the only game in town and it had the most money. So that was great. The tour's great because of that. There was a platform for us to earn our way to. Never given anything. We earned our way to do that. So, yeah. That's a whole nother subject, by the way.
No doubt. All right. So let's talk some golf, Weebs, because I want to get into
yes, sir.
Some of your stories and some of your insights, because as we look ahead a couple of weeks to this year's U.S. Open at Oakmont. Do you ever get an opportunity to go out there and play at Oakmont?
Oh, I played Oakmont twice, maybe three times, because I know I did an outing there. But the coolest thing about Oakmont is one time I played that it was tree-lined, and the next time I played, there were no trees. So
right.
I just went, wait a minute, what now? Because it was totally totally different as far as just picking out targets and knowing that if you hit it off that tree with a little turn one way or the other, that it would be more advantageous and all of those things. You kind of lost your targets. And on the other hand, it didn't make it less of a golf course. It just made it a different Oakmont. So to me, there's Oakmont 1 and Oakmont 2, and I don't care what order they're in. They're both unbelievable golf courses.
And Mark, when you look at playing in U.S. Open conditions, and particularly obviously out at Oakmont, you played in 9 U.S. Opens on the regular tour, 9 more out on the Champions Tour. The USGA does its best to make it not only a physical grind, but make it a mental grind. Talk about what it takes in order to get yourself in contention at a U.S. Open, because part of it is learning how to accept adversity and not letting it take your focus off what you're trying to achieve. If you end up in a U.S. Open rough, if you end up 2 or 3 putting a ball there at Oakmont from inside of, 5 feet, whatever the challenge is, talk about being able to maintain your focus under the adversity that U.S. Open conditions present.
Well, I think, first of all, I think you have to be mentally prepared weeks ahead of time, although you may be playing in tournaments prior to. I do think that you need to be mentally prepared because it is a different brand of golf. It is totally a different brand of golf. It is patience to the nines. I mean, it is one shot to the nth degree. You just have to stay in the moment, and you have to be ready for adversity because it's coming. You just don't know when and you don't know where, but you have to be ready for when it does to handle the situation and react to what's going on and with a clear head. And that takes a lot of mental prep for me anyway. I had to be ready knowing that if I'm playing a tour event and if I make a bogey on a par 5, I'm losing at least a shot to the field, possibly 2, but for sure in between 1 and 2. In a U.S. Open, it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. It's as relevant as you want to make. But to me, that's a bogey. I lost to the U.S. Open on that hole. I lost that hole. That's all. I didn't make a triple or a X or a 9 or let it get away from me. I just played as hard as I could, and that's what it gets. And I do remember not just the U.S. Open, but the U.S. Open seemed to be, because it was so difficult, being absolutely drained mentally at the end of the day, because you're trying not to overthink shots. At the same time, you're trying to give them enough thought and strategy as you think is the right amount. And it's hard to find what that is for each person, but once you find it, you need to stick to it. Part of the mental preparation, knowing that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that I just hit that, I shanked it out of the rough or whatever. We're on to the next. And now I have to deal with this. And again, mental prep for that stuff. That is kind of what we all think when we're playing our best golf, but it is really a finite point at the U.S. Open. I think because of the difficulty, the U.S. Open doesn't seem to rely on weather like the Open Championship. It relies on just difficult pin placements, how the hole is set up, whether it's a drivable par 4, that seems to be something that's part of the theme now for golf. That where you can make a 2 or you can make a 7. And that's fun for the gallery. That's fun to watch. Again, for me, it was preparing mentally, being ready to be ready, don't expect anything, but yet expect everything. So
you have to be aware, maybe on guard a little bit. Not so much defensive wise, but there's not a whole bunch of times that you really think offensively. Although I know the new player, the nowadays player, is 100% offensive. They play as hard. I mean, they just go at it. They just go right at everything. But I think the U.S. Open exposes, if you don't have your game, maybe strategy might win instead of strength. Who knows? I mean, we watched Bryson, who has incredible strength, but man, does he work his way around the golf course? He has great strategy. That all we talk about is how far he hits it. But he knows he needs to be to the right on a certain hole location, on a certain hole, to have the best angle in or the best, even if it's defensive. Not going at the pin, just being able to put it where he wants to put it. There's so much that goes into that at the U.S. Open, and that's why it's fun to watch. I watch a lot of golf now because obviously I have a son that plays. I'm also working with some college kids, mainly short game, but who knows where we're going to go from there. But we talk a lot of strategies and getting to where you're comfortable with your game and trusting yourself and all those really good tidbits that you have when you're playing well. And I learned from the best. I mean, in my mind, I learned from the Nicklaus's, Watson's, Floyd's, Trevino's, Hubert Green, Fuzzy, Dave Stockton, Andy Bean. I mean, these were the guys that I watched, and they were incredible human beings, but incredible golfers as well. Kind of a bonus. And, you know, I got to learn from these guys. That's how I teach now. I teach everything I've learned. I don't have a theory or a method. I just kind of try to take advantage of how fortunate I was to learn all this from these incredible golfers. As long as you don't talk to a 20-year-old, they wouldn't know who I'm talking about.
Indeed. So let's take that a step further, Weaves, because we've seen Rory have a storybook start of the season, winning at Pebble, the Players in it at Augusta. Scotty is clearly back since the hand accident early this year, having just won his third major at the PGA. Bryson being the defending U.S. Open champion. Do you think the winner comes from one of those three? Do you think there's somebody else in the field that can take this one? Because Oakmont is long and difficult, and you got to hit it straight, and you got to be able to putt well. Who do you like?
Well, I like all those guys you mentioned for a number of reasons. They're great players, and they totally get up for majors. Totally, you can see it. The prep work, the what you read about it, how much time they're spending. They're working on certain shots. I would think Oakmont, the normal player, is working on driving because they're long and straight, and even if they're a little crooked, dog leg right or dog leg left, you're not really cutting the corner unless they mess with the tees a little bit. You need to hit it pretty good to get to the corner of the dog leg. So, you know, big time driving. Colin Morikawa is a pretty good driver. If he gets his driver working where he's hitting a lot of fairways, I believe he has the patience. Hasn't he won a couple majors?
Yes.
So, you know, you get somebody that falls into that little where they're just hitting a lot of fairways. You know, I used to joke about it when I played practice rounds with my buds. And if I was in the fairway and they were in the rough, I would always say, hey, you should have hit it over here. It's a way better lie. So chances, you know, your odds kind of go up from the fairway. So. And that's kind of typical U.S. Open, I think, and positioning your ball around. And I think there's a lot of angles involved. And it's going to be brutal. It's long and demanding and awesome at the same time. You're looking around thinking, what a great golf hole. You know, there's not a lot of courses you really look at a hole and go, what a great hole. This is a great hole. And you say that a lot at Oakmont. So,
Mark, one more before I let you go. And you mentioned your son a moment ago. Give us an update. How are things going for Gunner?
Well, the main thing with Gunner is he just had a little boy. So he has a little
boy,
a little over 3 years old, and a little boy that is about 3 months old. So that's the major part of his life. Right now, he is over for a 4-week stint playing on the DPS tour and or the their version of the Corn Ferry Tour. Gunner is exempt for that this year, and he's semi-exempt for the DP Tour. So he's over over in Europe quite a bit. Right now, he's in Spain, and his game is sharp. We've worked hard, and he made some changes, and they're great changes, and now it's just a matter of going and playing some golf, and that sometimes rolls off your tongue like it's super easy to do, and sometimes it's a little harder than others. So
so
right now that's it. His game is in nice form, and if he goes and plays just his normal game of golf, he'll be in the hunt. I'm sure of it.
Weeps, before I let you go, remind our listeners, how can they stay up to date with all the things you're out there doing? Maybe get a lesson from Mark Wiebe, whether they can do that online or on social media.
Sure. Actually, my my email is probably the best. That's mwiebegolf@gmail.com. Also, I'm on Instagram, and you can contact me through that. And I also have a website, markwiebegolf.com, that I also can get messages from. And I am doing some remote lessons now. Some of them are just audio, and some of them are either live or videos back and forth. And, you know, whatever works at the time, as long as we can make somebody be a little better than they were, totally happy with it. Yeah. And those are my deals. I think on my Instagram, I'm not even sure what you just, if you look up Mark Wiebe, you'll find it.
Well, Mark, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your day to come and be a part of the show. It's always great getting to spend some time with you. I've been blessed to do it now 14 times.
Wow.
I hope we get the opportunity to catch back up with you again soon.
I hope so, Chris. And listen, I know you had a little bit of health issues here lately, so feel better, buddy.
I appreciate that very much, Weebs. You're the best, my friend. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
Thanks, buddy. Always good being on with you. Thanks, man.
You bet. That is the great Mark Wiebe, folks. Again, mwiebegolf@gmail.com is how you can reach out to him over email. markwiebegolf.com is his website. At markwiebe33 is where you can find him on X, and I believe also on Instagram. But that guy's great. I love Mark. Every time I get to spend some time with him, it is an absolute treat. And look, if you live out in Arizona, now that he's got the video part figured out, a playing lesson from a major champion, how great is that? Why wouldn't you sign up for that? Why wouldn't you go see him? Like I say, he is just not only a fantastic player that he was, you don't win a senior open champion without being a great player. You don't get out on tour, period, without being a great player, but he is a fantastic person on top of all of that. So I look forward to catching up with Mark. Hopefully we get to do that a little bit later on this summer. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on part one of this week's show. My sincere thanks to Tom Patry and Mark Wiebe for making it so much fun to be a part of. I hope you enjoyed it. And I also hope you'll come back for part two, featuring one of the all-time great instructors in our game, Rob Schrenno, my Goomba. And then Dr. Bob Winters will be here, fresh off his trip out to Hawaii. He went to Kauai, so you can hear about some great golf courses out there. And then we'll get into some of the things that his junior players are out there achieving and looking ahead to the U.S. Women's Open, where he's got several players out there as well, some amateurs doing some great things. So you're going to want to hear all about that. Folks, I can't thank you enough for continuing to being the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts. I appreciate each and every one of you out there so very much. Until next time, hit 'em straight, my friends.
Coming down the mountain, I take a breath of sin. Can't tell the day or time, but I know this day will end. On a mission I can't see, they say I am the one. In the end, it's you.